Hello, and welcome to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Wednesday, January 17th, 2024. I'm your reader, Janet Griffith. Starting on today's front page, our first headline reads, Bill would prevent release of most mugshots. Backers say photos harm reputations, stay online regardless of trial verdicts. By Tom Barton. Mugshots of people booked into Iowa jails following an arrest would no longer be considered public records, with some exceptions, under legislation advanced Tuesday in the Iowa House. The bill would stop police, county sheriffs, and other law enforcement in the state from releasing booking photos following a person's arrest or while in the custody of a law enforcement agency, unless the person is a fugitive, has been convicted, pleaded guilty to the charges, is deemed an imminent threat to an individual or public safety by law enforcement or a prosecuting agency, or the photo's release would aid authorities in apprehending the individual. House Study Bill 531 also makes an exception if a judge orders release of the booking photo to further a legitimate interest. Supporters say the photos go against due process and irreparably harm people's personal and professional reputations. Once released, the photos can be widely circulated online for employers, landlords, neighbors, and others to see, becoming a barrier to housing, employment, and personal relationships, regardless of whether the person ends up being convicted of a crime. Individuals who had charges dropped or were found not guilty can find it difficult to repair their online reputation, said Lisa Davis Cook, a lobbyist for the Iowa Association for Justice. The organization, which represents Iowa trial lawyers, is registered in favor of the bill. Davis Cook said the legislature has done a lot in previous years to allow people to expunge their criminal record if they received a not guilty verdict or their case was dismissed. I think this bill is kind of the next step in that, Davis Cook said. Law enforcement and media organizations argued there's a public safety interest in having the photos publicly available to provide transparency in law enforcement and that the public has a right to know who police have arrested and be visually identified to distinguish between individuals with the same name. They note the booking photos come with a disclaimer from Iowa law enforcement that individuals are innocent until proven guilty. We have concerns with making more records confidential, said Doug Strook, a lobbyist representing the Iowa State Bar Association. The group is registered undecided on the bill. Strook noted that while a person's booking photo would not be made public, their arrest and charges still are public record. All this is doing is removing a picture that seems like a tremendous half measure that doesn't appear to go toward one of the major stated causes for introducing the bill, Strook said. Supporters said they are not trying to conceal basic arrest information, such as an arrestee's name and the charge, but they argue that booking photos cause the subjects more lasting harm. They're innocent until proven guilty, but that photo is still out there, Davis Cook said, and that's what people are going to focus on, and that's what's going to be put out for the world to see. Representative Bill Gustoff, Republican of Des Moines, who chaired a subcommittee of lawmakers that advanced the bill for further discussion by the Iowa House Public Safety Committee, agreed. People don't go digging and read criminal records and police blotters and dockets, Gustoff said, but they do see pictures put on the internet. Even if it's expunged, you can't pull that down from the internet. Catherine Lucas, general counsel at the Iowa Department of Public Safety, said the bill would be incredibly burdensome for counties to verify whether a person was convicted or pleaded guilty. There's no mechanism to directly communicate between the court system, Lucas said. Every single time they're going to get a public records request for a mugshot, someone from the counties is going to have to confirm with the judicial branch whether there has been a conviction, what's happened with that conviction. We think these being public does serve the public interest, and we think the system works well. The bill was filed by State Representative Phil Thompson, Republican of Boone, chair of the House Public Safety Committee. There is a box in this article that's called the Gazette's article removal process. In the era of the internet, a simple mistake, poor decision, or minor crime can show up in search results and affect lives for a long time. For years, the Gazette has offered a process for people to request online public safety articles and photos involving them to be unpublished from the Gazette's website. The Gazette uses guidelines to determine whether stories and photos about arrests should be removed from its website. The request must be made by the person accused of criminal activity in the story. The case has been adjudicated by the court system. This means that charges have been dismissed or a judgment of some sort has been imposed by the court system. The person has completed required jail prison time associated with the charge and or an expungement of the record has been granted. Requests can be filed through a form on the Gazette website at thegazette.com. Media's quick projection of Trump victory draws criticism by Aaron Murphy. Many Iowa Republicans had not yet cast their choice for president, State Party Chairman Jeff Kaufman said, when outside those schools and churches that were hosting the state's first-in-the-nation presidential precinct caucuses, a slew of national media organizations had already declared Donald Trump the winner. Kaufman and at least one of the other presidential campaigns took exception with the early declaration of Trump's victory. The Associated Press, Fox News, CNN, CBS News, and NBC News all called the caucuses for Trump around 7:30 p.m. Monday, just a half hour after the caucuses were scheduled to start. The national news organization's expansive and sophisticated elections reporting operations often enable them to project election winners long before the official results are tallied, especially when the outcome is not particularly close, as was the case with Trump's 30-point win in the Iowa Republican caucuses. Nonetheless, that early report rubbed Kaufman the wrong way. The state chairman of the Republican Party of Iowa, which put on Monday night's caucuses, on Tuesday morning issued a statement about the fast calls of Trump's victory. In the statement, Kaufman said just around 300 votes had been officially counted when the news organizations declared Trump the winner. Media outlets calling the results of the 2024 first-in-the-nation caucus less than half an hour after precinct caucuses had been called to order, before the overwhelming majority of Iowans had even cast their ballot, was highly disappointing and concerning, Kaufman said. National news organizations were able to determine quickly that Trump would be the winner by analyzing data from interviews with Iowa Republicans on their way into the caucuses. Those entrance polls were conducted by the news organizations themselves and by Edison Research, whose national election pool is used by multiple national news organizations. Spokespeople for multiple news organizations that made the early call said the data in those entrance polls, combined with the early results that were reported by the Republican Party of Iowa, gave them all the information they needed to determine Trump was poised for victory. Many of the organizations, including the AP, CNN, Fox News, and NBC News, reported on or explained on air Monday night how their organization came to determine so quickly that Trump would win the caucuses. The news organization's early call was complicated by the difference between an election and a caucus. In order to avoid disrupting voters' participation in an election, news organizations will not project an election's winner until after the polls close. That is, they will not declare a winner until voters can no longer cast a ballot. Caucuses do not have a hard time for the presidential preference section. The Iowa Republican caucuses began at 7 p.m. Monday, but the presidential straw polls occurred depending on each of the 1,657 precincts' order of business. Kaufman said the early calls of Trump's victory interfere with the caucuses because, unlike an election, at a caucus, participants hear from speakers and could be swayed to change their mind before making their choice. One of the key differences between the Iowa caucus and a standard primary election is that Iowans have the chance to listen to presidential candidates or their surrogates and deliberate to make an informed decision, Kaufman said in his statement. There was no need to rush one of the most transparent grassroots democratic processes in the country. Spokespeople for multiple national organizations who made the early call for Trump said they were told by the state party that voting would take place by 7:20 p.m. local time, 10 minutes before the networks called Trump the winner. Chuck Grassley hospitalized being treated for infection. Senator is receiving antibiotic infusions, his office says, by Aaron Murphy. Longtime Iowa Republican U.S. Senator Chuck Grassley is receiving treatments for an infection at a hospital, his office said Tuesday. The 90-year-old Grassley is receiving antibiotic infusions for an unspecified infection, his office said in a news release. He is being treated at a hospital in the Washington, D.C. area, the release said. Grassley is in good spirits and plans to return to work as soon as possible, following doctor's orders, according to the release. Grassley is expected to make a full recovery and an update will be provided when available, a spokesman for his office said. In January 2023, Grassley underwent surgery for a hip fracture. He told reporters at the time he injured himself while doing a stupid thing in the kitchen of his Washington, D.C. townhouse. It didn't work, and I fell and broke my hip, he said. Grassley has represented Iowa in the U.S. Senate since 1981, and in 2022 was reelected to his 8th 6-year term. Two crashes caused traffic jam on I-380. Cedar Rapids police respond to 58 crashes in under 2 days, by Emily Anderson. The downtown Cedar Rapids S-curve of Interstate 380 was backed up in both directions near the 7th Avenue Northeast exit Tuesday morning after two car crashes brought traffic to a standstill. The first crash happened at 7:20 a.m. and involved two vehicles on the southbound lanes of the interstate. The second crash, involving four vehicles heading north, happened at 7:45 a.m., according to Cedar Rapids Police. The crashes resulted in some minor injuries, police said, and they were cleared from the roadway by 9 a.m. The crashes were among 58 handled by Cedar Rapids Police so far this week, as of 11 a.m. Tuesday. Even though snow hasn't fallen for a couple of days, winter driving conditions still exist in the Cedar Rapids area because of bitter cold temperatures causing icy roads. The police department responded to 49 crashes Monday and another 9 Tuesday morning. One crash Monday involved a car falling off the I-380 bridge near Unity Point Health St. Luke's Hospital. Two people were injured and taken to the hospital, according to police. The Iowa State Patrol responded to 168 crashes in the state between 12:30 a.m. Friday and 10:30 p.m. Sunday. Property damage was reported in 148 of those crashes, and 20 involved personal injury. None were fatal. Police seek help finding armed robbery suspect by Emily Anderson. The Cedar Rapids Police Department is asking for help finding a suspect in an armed robbery earlier this month. Police believe Andrew Durr, 21, robbed a Cedar Rapids Bank and Trust in Northeast Cedar Rapids while displaying a gun on January 3rd, according to a news release from the Cedar Rapids Police Department. The U.S. Marshal's Office is offering a reward for information that leads to Durr's arrest. Durr is 5 feet 11 inches tall, weighs about 160 pounds. He is a white man with brown hair and brown eyes. Cedar Rapids Police Investigating Dead Body by Emily Anderson. Police are investigating a dead body found Tuesday morning in the 200 block of Edgewood Road Northwest. Cedar Rapids Police were called to the scene near the intersection with Johnson Avenue Northwest at 10:45 a.m. where they found a deceased person outside. The death is not being investigated as suspicious, according to police. Lawmakers advance bill to add raw cannabis flower to medical program. Legislators say they want more information and predict spirited conversation about the proposal. By Caleb McCullough. Iowa lawmakers are considering allowing medical marijuana patients to buy raw cannabis flower at the state's dispensaries, a move that could potentially greatly increase the number of patients in the state's limited program. Lawmakers advanced a bill, House Study Bill 532, to add the product out of a subcommittee on Tuesday, though they said they were looking to hear more from stakeholders and weigh other regulations to the state's program and sale of THC products. Under the proposed change, Iowa law would define the types of products available for sale at Iowa's five dispensaries, including vaporized dried raw cannabis, which is not currently allowed by state regulators. State law currently vests the authority to allow or prohibit various cannabis products with the State Medical Cannabidiol Board. The board allows the sale of tablets and capsules, topical products, and products that vaporize cannabis oil. Patients also are restricted to purchasing no more than 4.5 grams over 90 days unless they receive a waiver from their doctor. While the proposed bill specifies the cannabis would be intended to be vaporized, patients would be able to burn and smoke it as well. Iowa's medical cannabis companies have advocated for the change, saying cannabis flower would dramatically reduce costs and could attract new patients that are currently turned off by high prices. Selling cannabis flower would allow Iowa's medical cannabis producers to bypass the process of extracting THC from the cannabis plant, said Dane Schumann, a lobbyist for Bud & Mary's, formerly MedFarm, one of the two cannabis producers and dispensers in the state. Schumann said allowing the change could cut production costs in half. What we hear consistently from patients of the medical program, even those that like the effects of what it delivers for their conditions, is that the program is simply too expensive, he said. Schumann also said that Iowa is one of the only medical programs in the country that does not allow the sale of raw cannabis flower. The addition of raw cannabis to Iowa's medical program would likely greatly expand the number of patients who hold medical marijuana cards, Iowa Department of Public Safety General Counsel Catherine Lucas told lawmakers during Tuesday's meeting. In Minnesota, she said, medical cannabis patients increased from 20,000 to 100,000 after the state added the product to its program. She warned that increasing the number of people lawfully using cannabis in the state could lead to higher impaired driving fatalities. Iowa currently has more than 18,000 medical cannabis cardholders, according to a December report from the Department of Health and Human Services. Robert Schreck, a doctor and member of Iowa's Medical Cannabidiol Board, said he was concerned that the product, which can be smoked, would tarnish what he considers to be the strictly medical program Iowa currently offers. Nowhere in American medicine is there another compound, molecule, or substance that is dispensed by combustion, he said. It doesn't make medical sense. The state's Medical Cannabis Board denied a petition to add flower to the list of available products earlier this year. They cited the same concerns around the introduction of smoking, the rise of telehealth certifications for the program, and an inaccuracy in dosing as results for the denial. Though the bill was advanced unanimously by a subcommittee of two Republicans and one Democrat, lawmakers said they wanted to have further conversations about the effects of the bill. Representative Hans Wiltz, a Republican from Ottumwa, said amendments were likely as the bill moves forward through the lawmaking process. "There's room in this bill for amendments for whatever might be brought to the table," he said, "but I do believe it is a spirited conversation, one that Iowans are having as well." Regions president stepping down, Michael Richards to leave the board in April after 8 years, by Vanessa Miller. After 8 years on the Board of Regents, and nearly seven as its president, Michael Richards on Tuesday resigned his presidential post, effective today, and announced he's leaving the board entirely at the end of April, 3 years before his term expires. "Governor, I am most grateful for being given this opportunity," Richards wrote to Governor Kim Reynolds in his resignation letter, dated Tuesday, January 16th. "If there's anything I can do to help in the future, please do not hesitate to contact me." In a statement announcing his resignation, Richards, 75, of West Des Moines, said serving as a member of the board has been a true honor and privilege. "I want to publicly thank Governor Reynolds and Governor Branstad, who gave me the opportunity to serve in this important role." He also thanked the many regents he served with, who have given generously of their time and expertise, and the university presidents and staff he's worked alongside. "I'm extremely proud of all that we've accomplished over the past 7 years," he said. "Our public universities are among the finest in the nation, and I've enjoyed the collaborative relationship to find ways to continue to improve." Although Richards didn't give a reason for his early departure, he said, "I am making this announcement now to allow for a smooth transition in leadership, and to hopefully give Governor Reynolds ample time to find and name my replacement." With Richards' resignation, President Pro Tem Sherry Bates becomes interim president until the board elects a new leader at a future meeting. With Iowa losing pharmacies, lawmakers advance new rules. Bill establishes stronger requirements for pharmacy benefit managers, by Tom Barton. Iowa House lawmakers advanced a bill Tuesday aimed at reducing prescription drug costs for Iowans by strengthening some requirements for pharmacy benefit managers. A three-member subcommittee forwarded the bill for further discussion by the Iowa House Commerce Committee. The legislation proposed by the Iowa Insurance Division, among its provisions, would require pharmacy benefit managers to owe a duty of good faith and fair dealing with Iowa pharmacies. House Study Bill 536 would also require pharmacy benefit managers, known as PBMs, the companies that function as intermediaries between insurance providers and drug manufacturers, to use the national average drug acquisition cost when determining what price to reimburse pharmacies for dispensing medications. The Federal Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services calculated value attempts to capture the average price that wholesalers charge to pharmacies. Pharmacists have said they are selling many common brand-name prescriptions at a loss because PBMs reimburse them less than a pharmacy's cost to acquire the drug. Using the national average would standardize the information PBMs and the Iowa Insurance Division use when looking at drug costs, supporters said. "This provides a nationally recognized way of pricing prescription drugs," said State Representative John Forbes, Democrat of Urbandale, a retired pharmacist who once owned Medicap Pharmacy. Lawmakers said the bill would aid independent community pharmacies that have struggled because of PBM practices. "We think that transparency is much needed," said Seth Brown, Director of Public Affairs with the Iowa Pharmacy Association. "The publicly available metric is also very welcome for our members." The proposed legislation would also prohibit retaliation by a PBM against a pharmacy or a pharmacist for filing a complaint with the insurance division, and they could no longer charge certain fees to pharmacies not yet in their network. "PBMs think pharmacies should be paying them to have the privilege of doing business with them," Forbes said, "and in the process are nickel and diming community pharmacies out of thousands of dollars." A Maquoketa pharmacy has led a lawsuit that claims CVS Health and its Caremark pharmacy benefit manager violated antitrust laws and illegally collected fees from pharmacies that fill Medicare prescriptions. Should the community pharmacies prevail, CVS would have to return hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars, its PBM recouped from independent pharmacies over the past 4 years, Axios reported. Forbes cited the lawsuit for including the retaliation provision. "Basically, it says if a pharmacy does that, the PBMs come back and say, 'We're going to kick you out of the network,' or 'We're going to do a bunch of extra audits on your pharmacy,'" he said. PBMs play a major role in negotiating drug prices and reimbursements for pharmacies, but operate with little transparency and oversight, lawmakers, pharmacists, and patient advocates argue. PBMs determine which pharmacies will be included in a prescription drug plans network and how much those pharmacies will be paid for their services. PBMs also regulate which drugs are covered under a specific plan and set copays, negotiate rebates with drug manufacturers, and process prescription medication claims for a fee for insurance companies, among other roles. Three of the companies, CVS, Caremark, Express Scripts, and OptumRx, collectively control about 80% of the market. Doug Struck is lobbyist representing Pharmaceutical Care Management Association, which represents pharmacy benefit managers. He raised concerns with the retaliation provision in the bill, saying the association worries it would prohibit a simple non-renewal of a contract should a pharmacy file a complaint. And the PBM is not able to make decisions based in their business interest because they're simply lumped into this catch-all provision that anytime someone's filed a complaint, if you don't renew the contract, that's in bad faith, he said. Additionally, he said the bill would prevent PBMs from recouping costs of vetting pharmacies asking to join their network. Mike Triplett, who represents Express Scripts, a subsidiary of Cigna Healthcare, questioned why lawmakers have not looked at legislation dealing with pharmacy services administrative organizations. They're connected with the country's three largest wholesalers and provide a range of services to independent pharmacies, including supporting the evaluation and execution of contracting with PBMs. You've been legislating and regulating PBMs since 2007, Triplett said. To my knowledge, you've not done anything to legislate or regulate PSAOs in Iowa. There are complaints made against PBMs that we are not reimbursing what was acquired through a PSAO. That's the other half of the equation we would encourage you to look at. Pharmacies across Iowa have closed at an alarming rate over the past decade plus, partly because insurance payouts don't cover drug costs. Nearly 100 pharmacies across the state have shut their doors since 2008, according to research from Michael Andresky, associate professor of pharmacy at Drake University, in a recent study conducted in collaboration with the Health Professions Tracking Center at the University of Iowa Carver College of Medicine. Independent pharmacies saw the largest hit, with 87 stores closed from 2008 to 2022, a 38% decrease. Rural pharmacies saw a 19% decrease, with 72 shutting their doors, according to the study. Forbes said he's hopeful the bill and other forthcoming legislation will help keep rural pharmacies in Iowa in business. Now the PBMs are going to say if a bill like this passes, you're going to see prescription drug costs go up, he said. And I just hope you really look into it and see what's happening across this state in rural areas, where you're going to see a large number of pharmacies close in the next 12 months. DeSantis and Haley, small gap, big consequences. Trump wins biggest ticket out of Iowa. Will it cancel the other two? By James Q. Lynch. There's no doubt that former President Donald Trump, with his best-in-field showing Monday night in the Iowa Republican caucuses, as well as his own private jet, can claim one of the proverbial three tickets out of Iowa. Trump, according to unofficial results, ran away with Iowa's quadrennial straw poll at more than 1,600 precinct caucuses with nearly 51% of the ballots cast, compared with 21% for Florida Governor Ron DeSantis and 19% for former South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley. However, the caucuses are less about crowning a nominee than signaling who has the momentum and resources to stay in the race and who should return to their day job. It's not always about who finishes first. Rather, it's about beating expectations, said Tim Hagel, a University of Iowa political science professor. Trump had a very good night. The path is harder for DeSantis and Haley, but the race isn't over. With Trump dominating the contest, the caucuses were seen as a race for second place. The large gap between Trump's 51% and the second and third place finishers probably isn't as important as the small gap between DeSantis and Haley, according to Barbara Trish, a Grinnell College political science professor. Second stays in regardless and might get some bumps, she said. The margin between second and third is more important certainly for DeSantis, but maybe for Haley too. Despite Haley's surge in the polls, it wasn't a surprise to see her finishing third, based on the lack of enthusiasm her supporters showed in the Des Moines Register NBC News MediaCom Iowa poll released Sunday, Trish said. The poll found 49% of her fans were only mildly enthusiastic and 12% not that enthusiastic. As close as DeSantis and Haley finished, I don't think it matters whether you're second or third, said Republican Party of Iowa Chair Jeff Kaufman. Both campaigns can spin that, can claim momentum. Regardless of the order of finish, both won tickets out of Iowa, but without naming DeSantis or Haley, Kaufman said that noted that some tickets could be cashed in 2028. The near tie for second is bad for DeSantis, good for Haley, said Stephen Schmidt, a professor emeritus of political science at Iowa State University. Despite finishing behind DeSantis, Haley can make the argument that he failed to deliver even after spending all of his campaign in Iowa, Schmidt said. DeSantis has had more campaign events in Iowa than Trump and Haley combined. He also had endorsements from Governor Kim Reynolds as well as from Bob Vanderplaats, president of the Family Leader, an organization of Christian conservatives based in Urbandale. What matters now, Kaufman said, is whether Haley can use her Iowa performance to narrow the gap between her and Trump in New Hampshire. Or does DeSantis capitalize by picking up those Christie supporters in next Tuesday's primary? Based on polling there, nothing is wrapped up. Former New Jersey Governor Chris Christie, who polls showed was leading DeSantis in the Granite State, has dropped out of the race. Although Haley scored her best numbers in Polk and surrounding counties, and in Linn County and Johnson County, where she won, Dante Scala, who teaches political science at the University of New Hampshire in Manchester, was not impressed. Haley's numbers with college-educated and suburban voters, who he believes are more similar to New Hampshire voters than Iowa's older rural voters, makes me pessimistic about her growth potential here in New Hampshire. Or, as Drake University political science professor Dennis Goldford wondered, has the Haley boom been revealed to be a bubble? Haley's third-place finish also makes it hard for her to make it a me-or-Trump contest going into New Hampshire, where the race is much closer. Trump leads Haley 45% to 31%. Longtime New Hampshire GOP strategist Mike Dennehy, who is skeptical Trump would break 50%, isn't sure conventional wisdom applies in 2024. That is the story of the night, Dennehy said. Second place is so distant that it doesn't matter. DeSantis' second place finish breathes fresh life into a campaign that seemed to stall out as he fell behind Haley in polling during the last weeks of the race. Now it appears his all-in approach has paid off, at least for now. He can ride that for a bit here, Scala said. In New Hampshire, DeSantis was tied with Vivek Ramaswamy at 6%, behind Christie at 9%. Ramaswamy ended his campaign Monday as the caucus results were announced. The competitiveness of the race may have declined considerably as a result of Monday night, said Chris Larimer, University of Northern Iowa political science professor. The pressure is now on Haley to try to make this competitive in New Hampshire and beyond. Or, as Goldford said, Haley has to finish off DeSantis in New Hampshire and South Carolina to make it a two-person race. If reports of his invisibility in New Hampshire are accurate, he's probably toast, Goldford said of DeSantis. He's been a ghost, agreed Scala, referring to DeSantis allocating his time and resources to Iowa rather than New Hampshire. The DeSantis strategy appears to be shifting the campaign to South Carolina and the 16 Super Tuesday primaries and caucuses March 5th. But his distant second-place finish in Iowa failed to meet the early expectations for his campaign and would present a real challenge for his campaign in terms of keeping momentum and fundraising efforts, Larimer said. However, Hagel points out that Democratic President Joe Biden did poorly in Iowa and New Hampshire in 2020, but turned things around in South Carolina. It may be a long shot, but Larimer sees an opportunity for Haley and DeSantis to improve their fortunes in the upcoming contest. Perhaps as the race moves to primary states, presumably with more expanded electorates and higher turnout rates, the potential is there for the race to become more competitive, he said. This seems less likely after last night's results and the way the campaign has unfolded thus far. Haley will come to New Hampshire to try to rally independents to come close to Trump, Dennehy said, but DeSantis has no margin for recovery and may be pressured to drop out of the race because he's been struggling for so long. He's a dead man walking, Dennehy said. But Haley has her challenges, especially with GOP voters in New Hampshire, he added. Her favorability-unfavorability rating is about 1-to-1, he said. Her support is coming almost exclusively from independent voters who can vote in the New Hampshire primary. Independents can account for as much as 40% of the primary vote there, he said, and Haley is trying to push it higher to counter Trump's support among Republicans. Upsetting Trump in New Hampshire might provide that spark for the Haley campaign, Scala said. Independents would love to poke him with a sharp stick. The question is whether Haley is that sharp stick, Scala said. However, it's not clear to Dennehy that independents and moderate Republicans will turn out for Haley. With the endorsement of New Hampshire Governor Chris Sununu, Haley has done a good job of pumping up her story, Dennehy said. They're exactly where they want to be a week out. However, Dennehy said, Trump's people are poised and ready, the most solid block. You are listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Wednesday, January 17th, 2024, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now let's turn to today's obituaries. Ruth K. Wackel, age 93, passed away peacefully on Saturday, January 13th, at Corridor Crossing Place in Cedar Rapids with her family by her side. Services will be held at 1 p.m. Friday, January 19th at the Cedar Memorial Chapel of Memories. Ruth was born on September 20, 1930 in Berlin, Germany, the daughter of Hans and Gertrude Holzberger. Ruth had attended dressmaking school, seamstress school, from 1947 until 1950 while in Germany. She met and married Marvin Wachel of Walker, Iowa, on July 3, 1950 in Berlin while he was serving in the U.S. Army. The couple returned to Iowa later in 1950. Ruth enjoyed crafts and attending craft fairs, owning her business, Designs by Ruth. She liked to winter at their home in Port Richey, Florida, until her health prevented her from going. Online condolences can be left at phillipsfuneralhomes.com. Brandon Tex Gene McHugh, 35, of Cedar Rapids, passed away suddenly on January 11th. His loss is completely unexpected, and his family is profoundly saddened. Brandon was born on December 26, 1988, to Ronald Stearns and Kelly McHugh in Cedar Rapids. He was one of seven children. After high school, Brandon stayed close to his family and went on to have two beautiful children of his own. There will be a visitation Thursday, January 18th from 5 to 7 p.m. at Cedar Memorial Westside Chapel. The funeral service is Friday, January 19th at 1 p.m. at Cedar Memorial Westside Chapel, followed by the burial service at Mount Calvary Cemetery. The family deeply appreciates your support during this difficult time and ask that you make contributions to the Memorial Fund in lieu of flowers. Memorial Fund is on GoFundMe. Online condolences may be left at cedarmemorial.com. Larry W. Stone King of Monticello passed away Thursday, January 11th at his home. Visitation will be held from 4 to 7 p.m. on Friday, January 19th at Kramer Funeral Home in Monticello, where a vigil service will commence at 4 p.m. Visitation will continue at 9 a.m. prior to funeral mass at Sacred Heart Catholic Church in Monticello. Funeral Mass will commence at 10:30 a.m. on Saturday, January 20th at Sacred Heart Catholic Church, with burial to follow at the church cemetery. Reverend Paul Baldwin will officiate. Larry was born on December 31, 1934 in Stanwood, the son of Clarence and Floy Flansburg Stone King. Larry graduated from Monticello High School in 1953. He married Mary G. Seppel on April 20, 1954. They made their home in Monticello, Iowa. Mary died in 1992. Larry married Joan Spurschlage Weber on June 7, 1986. Larry worked at Freeze Motors in Monticello for over 20 years. He then went to work for Jones County Secondary Roads. He was employed there for 22 years until his retirement in 1997. Larry was a member of the Monticello Fire Department for 20 years and also served as chief. He was a member of the Monticello City Council for a number of years. Kramer Funeral Home in Monticello is assisting the family. Information is available at kramerfuneral.com. Memorials may be sent to the family in care of Kramer Funeral Home. Dolores Arlene Grulke, 85, of Hiawatha, died Friday, January 12th in St. Luke's Transitional Care. There will be no services. The interment will take place at Cedar Memorial Park Cemetery. Cedar Memorial Park Funeral Home is in charge of the arrangements. Dolores was born on February 3, 1938 in Jones County, the daughter of Carl and Dorothy Soakup Michaels. She married Raymond Ira Grulke on August 11, 1957 in Cedar Rapids. Dolores was employed at Rockwell Collins from 1971 to 1983. She loved making quilts, car races, antiques, and garage sales. She will be greatly missed by her family and friends. Memorials may be directed to the family. Brad Olson, age 67, of Atkins, passed away on Thursday, January 11th at St. Luke's Helen G. Nassif Transitional Care Center in Cedar Rapids. Funeral services will be held at 10:30 a.m. Monday, January 22nd at St. John Lutheran Church, Newhall, with Reverend Nick Palmer officiating. Visitation will be held Sunday, January 21st from 3 until 6 p.m. also at the church. In lieu of flowers, a memorial fund has been established. Interment will be at St. John Cemetery in Newhall. Brad was born on December 9, 1956, the son of Lyle and Nadine Schroeder Olson. He received the gift of holy baptism January 1, 1957, and was confirmed in the Lutheran Church in May 1971. Brad graduated from Norway High School with the class of 1975. In May 1979, he graduated from Iowa State University with a bachelor's degree in business. Brad was a proud brother of the Beta Sigma Psi Lutheran fraternity at Iowa State and a faithful Cyclone fan. Brad was a lifelong farmer and was known for raising Yorkshire hogs. He was a member of the Benton County Pork Producers, where he loved grilling during the fair. He was also a longtime 4-H leader with the Fremont Go-Getters. Online condolences may be left at phyllisfuneralhomes.com. Dennis Wally Usher, 79, of Cedar Rapids, passed away Thursday, July 11th at the Gardens of Cedar Rapids. Funeral service 4 to 4:30 p.m. Friday, January 19th at Murdoch-Linwood Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Cedar Rapids. A remembrance party will immediately follow from 4:30 to 8 p.m. at the Legacy Center at Murdoch-Linwood. Burial, Cedar Memorial Park Cemetery in Cedar Rapids on a later date. Dennis was born October 16, 1944, in Cedar Rapids, the son of Norman and Doris Keba Usher. He graduated from Jefferson High School and the University of Northern Iowa. On May 15, 1965, Dennis was united in marriage to Judy Vig in Cedar Rapids. He worked at Kirkwood Community College for 33 years as a continuing education director, Kirkwood softball complex director, and athletic director before retiring in 2000. Dennis was a member of the Cedar Rapids Jefferson Athletic Hall of Fame, the State 16-inch Iowa Softball Hall of Fame, and the Monday Atlas Club, held at CJ's Bar and Grill. Memorials may be directed to HACAP, 1515 Hawkeye Drive in Hiawatha. Michael Mike John Kepros, 87, of Marion, passed away on Sunday, January 14th. A vigil service will be held at 4:30 p.m. on Monday, January 22nd at Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Marion, followed by the Rosary. Following the Rosary, visitation will proceed until 7 p.m. on Monday at the funeral home. A Mass of Christian burial will begin at 10:30 a.m. on Tuesday, January 23rd at St. Joseph Catholic Church in Marion, where an additional visitation will be held 1 hour prior to the Mass. Burial will follow at Mount Calvary Cemetery in Cedar Rapids. Mike was born on May 27, 1936, in Cedar Rapids, the son of Frank P. and Sophia Nowak Kepros. He was a 1954 graduate of Marion High School and went on to serve honorably in the United States Navy from 1954 until 1958. Mike attended Loras College before spending 15 years at New Millerey Abbey from 1959 until 1974. He worked for Midland Forge for 24 years from 1974 until his retirement in 1998. On May 12, 1979, Mike was united in marriage to Cecilia Agnes Scanlon at St. Joseph Catholic Church in Marion. Memorials in Mike's memory may be directed to either St. Joseph Catholic Church or New Millerey Abbey in Piasta. Please share a memory of Mike at murdochfuneralhome.com. David Rogers, 97, of Cedar Rapids, went to be with Jesus on January 12th in Marion. Stuart Baxter Funeral and Memorial Services in Cedar Rapids is assisting the family. David served in the Army during World War II and graduated from Wheaton College, where he met his wife, Anna Lee. He was a Chicago businessman, but decided to become an elementary school teacher at the age of 36. He earned a Master of Education at Northern Illinois University. He then moved to Cedar Rapids to help start the Cedar Rapids Bible Chapel. He retired from teaching at age 62 and worked as a full-time volunteer as the assistant to the president of Emmaus Bible College in Dubuque for 15 years. At age 77, he began working as the director of mailing and inventory at his granddaughter's nonprofit, Bright Lights Ministry, where he continued until his recent illness. A memorial service will be held at 11 a.m. Saturday, February 3rd, at the Cedar Rapids Bible Chapel. Please share your support and memories with David's family on his tribute wall at stuartbaxter.com. Norma Jean Finnerty, 93, of Cedar Rapids, passed peacefully on January 13th at Keystone Cedars in Cedar Rapids. Norma was born June 10, 1930, in Keokuk, Iowa, to Sydney and Helen Barnes Lane. She married the love of her life, James Finnerty, on April 17, 1953, in the middle of a blizzard. Together, they raised two children, Daniel and Deborah. In Norma's earlier years, she spent her time as a paraprofessional at Pierce Elementary School, a bank teller at Collins Community Credit Union, and an administrative assistant at Rockwell Collins for 12 years, until retiring in 1991. Her favorite role, most of all, was being a mother and grandmother. Norma volunteered over 1,000 hours at Mercy Medical Center, was an avid fan of the Iowa Hawkeye football and basketball teams, and joined her Pinnacle Club and Breakfast Club. Visitation will be held on Sunday, January 21st, from 4 to 7 p.m. at Cedar Memorial Park Funeral Home. Funeral services will then be held at 10 a.m. Monday, January 22nd at Cedar Memorial Chapel of Memories. Entombment will follow in Cedar Memorial Park Cemetery. A memorial fund has been established in her name. Online condolences may be left at cedarmemorial.com. Arlene A. Holub, 88, of Center Point, passed away on Monday, January 15th at St. Luke's Hospital in Cedar Rapids from a short illness due to complications of COVID. Graveside service will be held at 11 a.m. on Saturday, January 27th at St. Joseph Catholic Cemetery in Prairieburg, with Father Sean Smith officiating. A time of fellowship will immediately follow at BIT Brewing in Central City, Iowa. Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service of Marion is assisting the family. Arlene was born on November 4, 1935 in Cedar Rapids, the daughter of Leo and Esther Shimerda Heaton. She was a 1953 graduate of Central City High School. On July 20, 1954, Arlene was united in marriage to Robert M. Holub at St. Joseph Catholic Church in Prairieburg. She worked at the post office in Prairieburg for 9 years before working 20 years at Rockwell Collins. Arlene was the first woman to serve on the city council and the first female mayor of Prairieburg. Please share a memory of Arlene at murdochfuneralhome.com. Nathaniel Nate Hubner, 50, died suddenly Sunday, January 14, 2024. He was a resident of Marion. According to his wishes, there will be no visitation or funeral. A celebration of life will be held later. Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service of Marion is assisting the family. Nathan was born in 1973 to William and Kathleen Hubner. He graduated from Marion High School, active in band, tuba, and computer club. Earned his nickname Computer Brain. Nathan attended Kirkwood Community College. He was a weightlifter, strongest man on earth. Nathan worked at Marion Hy-Vee Night Stock for over 30 years. He owned his own computer company, Nate's Computer Lab, specializing in communications and surveillance cameras. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be donated in his honor to the Heartland chapter of Youth for Christ. Please share a memory of Nathan at murdochfuneralhome.com. That concludes today's obituaries. Moving on to today's editorial page, there is one letter to the editor today. It is from Jay Stolba of Cedar Rapids. Headline reads, Republicans are full of bad ideas. As the Iowa legislature begins another session, they continue to push priorities that are not necessarily good for the working people of Iowa. They have a plan to reduce and consolidate boards and committees. That is a good idea, except it is being done more in the vein of increasing power rather than being more effective. With billions of dollars in surplus and even more in the taxpayer relief fund, their choice to give more tax breaks skewed to the wealthy even before last year's cuts take effect, while underfunding necessities efficient and effective for the middle and lower income Iowans. Mental health, child care, water quality, education, teacher pay, and retention are not sufficiently funded. Citizens go hungry, and the legislature and governor's focus is another tax cut. In addition, the legislature has limited oversight by having governor-appointed directors and committees rather than a cross-section of Iowans with the overall best interest of all Iowans considered. And just to make sure there aren't any challenges to their plan, the governor and attorney general have limited oversight by allowing government departments to withhold information from the state auditor, limiting his ability to do his job and keep the administration upfront and honest. It's a letter in today's Gazette from Jay Stolba of Cedar Rapids. Here is a guest column on today's editorial page. It is by Bob Watson. I have worked in the wastewater industry for 35 years. I have written about modern industrial agriculture for 40 years and the Iowa Nutrient Reduction Strategy and its forerunner, the Iowa Plan, for the last 15 years. I appreciate the Gazette's two-part water quality article, but it was confusing even to someone like me and wasn't really clear on what the Nutrient Reduction Strategy has actually accomplished. When I started writing about industrial agriculture, there were some 880,000 miles of tile lines draining Iowa's 24 million acres of cropland. There are now some 2 million miles of tile lines. Think of tile lines as sewer pipes, in this case allowing pollution to run directly into our surface waters. There are two pieces of science from the University of Iowa's IIHR Hydroscience and Engineering Department, where Chris Jones used to work, that will give you a clear and simple understanding of where Iowa is on clean water. One piece is that since the introduction of the Iowa Plan and the Nutrient Reduction Strategy, the water pollution from modern industrial agriculture in Iowa has actually doubled. The other piece of science is that all the conservation that has taken place to counter that pollution and all the conservation that may happen in the future will not begin to catch up to industrial ag's continuing increase in pollution. In other words, unless something drastically changes in this modern industrial row crop, feedlot, and CAFO agriculture, like what crops we grow and how we raise animals, Iowa will always have polluted water. Politics seem to be where these problems must be addressed. It is up to Iowa voters whether they will ever have clean water again. Of course, voting is problematic nowadays, too, since lying seems to be free speech in America, and we can't actually believe what many politicians are saying in order to make up our minds who to vote for. Bob Watson lives in Decorah. Here is a guest column by William Lambers. The headline is, Congress Must Feed Infants and Mothers. President Harry Truman was right when he said, no nation is any healthier than its children. Congress needs to live up to this standard by fully funding the WIC program that feeds low-income mothers and infants throughout America. The Special Supplemental Nutritional Program for Women's Infants and Children, or WIC, supports the most vulnerable of our society. According to the U.S. Department of Agriculture, WIC saves lives and improves the health and nutritionally at-risk women, infants, and children. Around 6.7 million benefit from the program. But right now, there is not enough funding being provided by Congress for the WIC program. Congress needs to act to fully fund WIC by the January 19th deadline for passing a spending bill to avoid a partial government shutdown. The USDA warns it is critical that Congress provide additional funding for WIC in the January appropriation. The longer Congress puts off fully funding WIC, the greater the risk to mothers, babies, and children seeking nutrition and health support from the program. Demand for WIC has increased, and Congress needs to increase the funding as well. WIC needs about $1 billion more from Congress this fiscal year, which is a relatively small amount when compared to the annual spending on nuclear weapons. If Congress fails to fund WIC, it will mean that mothers and infants living in poverty will lose access to the help they desperately need. According to the Food Research and Action Center, this would result in an unfortunate disruption of services and long waiting lists, leaving more women, infants, and young children hungry and unable to access other critical WIC services. We need to make sure that all mothers, infants, and children are cared for. The Biden administration is encouraging Congress to fully fund WIC. President Joe Biden's domestic policy advisor, Neera Tanden, cited the example of a WIC recipient in Brooklyn named Sarah, who received life-saving help after giving birth to her daughter in 2018. Thanks to WIC, she could afford fresh fruits, vegetables, eggs, and other staples, explained Tanden. Nutrition for infants for the first 1,000 days are absolutely critical because without it, they would suffer many ill health consequences. Impoverished families need help to provide nutrition for infants and children, and that is why WIC is so vital. WIC has been around since the 1970s. One of the senators who got WIC started, George McGovern, wrote, "The program has been a dramatic success in the United States, significantly improving the health and well-being of millions of young mothers and their children." McGovern, along with Senator Bob Dole, were among the leaders in getting WIC started, showing how it had bipartisan support in Congress. WIC is an investment in America's children and families that brings positive health results. Congress should make child nutrition a priority and fully fund WIC. Through WIC, we can ensure that all our infants, children, and mothers have the food and help they need to live. William Lambers is an author who partnered with the UN World Food Program on the book Ending World Hunger. We have a few minutes for sports before our time is up today. Here is today's article about Iowa football. Wallace Now Assistant Head Coach by John Stepp. Iowa football does not have news to share on an offensive coordinator, saying in a news release that the search is ongoing and an announcement is expected in the near future. But Coach Kirk Ferentz did announce a few other staff updates on Tuesday. Most notably, Seth Wallace has been promoted to assistant head coach while retaining his previous responsibilities as assistant defensive coordinator and linebackers coach. Seth is an excellent coach and has been an asset to our coaching staff for many years, Ferentz said in a news release. He works tirelessly to develop our players into outstanding men on and off the field. I'm grateful that he is part of our program. Wallace's base salary will increase from $775,000 to $1 million. The University of Iowa and this football program are both very special to me, Wallace said in the release. I'm appreciative of this new expanded role and look forward to preparing our athletes for the upcoming season and beyond. Linebackers who have thrived under Wallace's tutelage include Josie Jewell, Jack Campbell, and Jay Higgins. Jewell and Campbell were consensus All-Americans while at Iowa and are enjoying NFL careers. Higgins was a first-team All-American this past season and tied the program record for tackles in a season with 171. Wallace has been on Ferentz's staff since 2014, including as linebackers coach since 2016. He was the assistant defensive line coach and recruiting coordinator in 2014 and the cornerbacks nickelbacks coach in 2015. He was a graduate assistant at Iowa from 2006 to 2008 as well. The Coe College alum also held staff positions at Coe, Lake Forest, and Valdosta State before joining the Hawkeyes. Defensive coordinator Phil Parker's base salary will increase to $1.9 million, Ferentz also announced in Tuesday's news release. It is a 35.7% increase from Parker's previous base salary of $1.4 million. The big raise follows an outstanding season for Parker's defense, which led the country in yards allowed per play and was in the top five in several other key metrics. Parker became Iowa's first recipient of the Broyles Award, which goes to the top assistant coach in college football, and also won the American Football Coaches Association Assistant Coach of the Year Award after the season. Wide receivers coach Kelton Copeland will not return to Iowa football staff in 2024, as first reported last week by ESPN's Pete Thamel. Specifically, his contract has not been renewed, according to Tuesday's release. "I appreciate Kelton's contribution to the Hawkeye staff and wish him the very best," Ferentz said in the news release. Copeland is the second offensive coach to leave the Hawkeyes following offensive coordinator Brian Ferentz's firing. Copeland and Brian Ferentz were the two longest-tenured offensive assistant coaches on Kirk Ferentz's 2023 staff. "Iowa's offense, and especially its passing attack, struggled mightily in 2023. The Hawkeyes ranked dead last in the FBS in yards per game, yards per play, and passing efficiency, and was second to last in completion percentage. Copeland's departure opens the door for Iowa's next offensive coordinator to potentially have a say in who one of his colleagues could be." Tuesday's brief update on Iowa's ongoing offensive coordinator search was nearly 3 months, 78 days to be exact, after the October announcement of Brian Ferentz's upcoming dismissal, and 15 days after Iowa's 35-0 loss in the Citrus Bowl. Kirk Ferentz said while preparing for the bowl game in Orlando that he would like to think by the third week of January we got it done. Other schools in the Big Ten, such as Indiana, Michigan State, Northwestern, and Penn State, have filled their offensive coordinator vacancies. And finally, this piece about girls' high school wrestling. Headland finds new strength. Marion sophomore has eye on state podium finish after shoulder surgery. By Riley Cole. At the 2023 IGHSAU State Tournament, Marion's Natalie Headland was on the verge of advancing to the second day and potentially making her way onto the podium as a freshman. Then the unthinkable happened. She dislocated her shoulder and had to medically forfeit out of the tournament. Headland underwent shoulder surgery over the summer and continues to wrestle with a shoulder brace. But she is back now with a 17-3 record. "Overcoming a shoulder injury has been quite the learning experience. It's been a long road, but I think it's made me realize that I have to push myself and work hard," Headland said. "It, wrestling, just doesn't come because it's something I've done for a really long time. It's something you have to want and work towards." Marion coach Jason Haig knows Headland has been doing just that, working hard to get back to the level of competition she was at a year ago. She believes she's getting closer every day. "She continues to fight back from her surgery earlier in the year," Haig said. "She's still working and getting back in her groove to where she was. Each and every time she comes out, she's looking more confident with her shoulder and everything else. Working to overcome her shoulder injury and surgery has been no easy task, but it has given her a new outlook on her personal strength. It makes me realize how tough of a person I am and defines me in so many ways," Headland said. "I've learned that I'm a lot stronger than I was, mentally and physically." Just as Headland has had to fight back from her injury, Haig said he sees that same type of fight when she steps onto the wrestling mat. "It's a testament to the type of wrestler she's become since starting the sport in third grade." "She has a lot of fight," Haig said. "She goes out with confidence that she's going to win every match, and she wins a lot of them. Even if she does lose, she comes off and learns from it. She's definitely a competitor and hates to lose." With less than 10 days before the IGHSAU Super Regionals on January 26th, Headland has had the postseason circled on her calendar since that fateful day last February. And that does it for today's reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Wednesday, January 17th, 2024. I'm your reader, Janet Griffith. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, anytime. Thanks for listening.
In Africa, 5-year-old Charu has no choice. She and millions like her must walk miles every day for dirty water. But together, we can end their walk by providing clean water close by. Instead of spending hours walking to get water that makes them sick, girls can be in a classroom that expands their minds, and moms will gain back time to care for their families. Sons and daughters can grow up strong, finally free of sicknesses caused by dirty water. At World Vision, care about clean water runs deep. Deep enough to reach one new person with clean water every 10 seconds. Because every child, every person, everywhere deserves clean water and the chance to rise to their full potential. It's true. When you just add water, you change a life. Learn more at worldvision.org.